socialists and social democrats at the social functions, seeing lots of colleagues in the media space, the independent journalism space, and thinking about kind of that whole corny, this the better world is possible thing, because mm-hmm. that seems to be what's taken over the federal NDP, that right. sort of very, like, left of center policy and politics. So it was a really interesting day. Yeah, this morning I was there when they announced that Avi Lewis is the new leader. Mm. Later in the day, Emily, you and I went for a tour of the Ukrainian Labor Temple mm-hmm. in North Winnipeg. And I guess I'm kind of like immersed in the interestingness of something having just occurred and that will be like leading into some kind of future, but then also having gone to a very historical place that really reaches into the past,
yeah.
where we got to see old ass like costumes in the dressing room and like but anyways, it was a really cool Ukrainian Labor Temple, folks. If you're in Winnipeg,
you gotta come do a tour. It's a historic site, and it's absolutely beautiful. And I think it speaks to this idea of community. There was actually a church that had rented it out while we were there, but it served that purpose for the Ukrainian community, for the immigrant community, you know, 100 years ago, mm-hmm. Providing that cultural space where they're doing art, they're doing music, they're doing
organizing
theater
too.
Organizing.
Yeah.
Which I think as we, you know, move into this new phase of what is going to happen, I think thinking about community and the ways that we build community are especially important.
So I'm feeling discombobulated or, you know, mixed up with this sort of looking into the future, but then being pulled into the past. And then today it's like, well, where do I sit?
Right.
But one thing that was really special about being here is how Indigenous things are. And that, of course, it's in Montreal too. And so it's very common, but I don't know, man, like something was really special here. Kevin brought in Chickadee, an elder, to mm-hmm. Kick off our symposium. Mm-hmm. There was smudging from a woman named Jen. I found that all really moving yesterday. Mm-hmm. Leah Gazan bought me a hot dog at the Yellow Dog. It's just like the Metsi big billboard on Portage or something. Like, so it's been really kind of culturally interesting, but that also makes me curious about how the John Howard Society in this city mm-hmm. and in Brandon
right.
Is working towards the TRC.
Right.
And or truth and reconciliation mm-hmm. in general.
Yeah, definitely. So we wanted to talk a bit about the truth and reconciliation.
So why did you choose these ones? How many calls to action were there in total?
94.
And you highlighted a few here. Why did you highlight these ones?
Because they are relevant to the work that we're doing here. Mm-hmm. And there was recently is the 10-year anniversary of the TRC calls to action in 2025. Mm-hmm. And so the Prime Minister put out a grand statement about it. And as we've worked here, it's given us time to reflect on, you know, the budget decisions and the different decisions of government and what they say and then what they do.
Does the John Howard Society also kind of lobby government for policy?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we do advocacy work. The John Howard Canada group has a lot of... They actually just had a John Howard Week, John Howard Society Week, where they mm-hmm. got all these criminal justice experts from across Canada to present on bail reform.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all on YouTube if anyone wants to get into the weeds on that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, this leads into, you know, we work with a lot of people who are Indigenous because there are overrepresentation of Indigenous people mm-hmm. in prisons.
Did I read that it was more than 80% in Manitoba?
I don't have the stats offhand, but it's
so quite So we keep stats for the students that we teach, and it's about 80% in men's. And in my work with women, I would say it's 98% Indigenous, probably.
So just, again, for listeners, that's 80% Indigenous men and 98% Indigenous women.
Yeah.
Literally.
That I get to work with, yeah. Yeah, and so I go into the Remand Center, teach four classes a week. And I get 8 students in each class, right? So that's my limit. And the Remand Center right now is where people are taken when they're charged or when they're awaiting sentencing or they're remanded, right? Mm-hmm. And it's coded for 300. Since I started there, it's almost always been more than 500 people. So there's 8x10 cells, 2 people in bunks, and 1 person on the floor in every cell in the Remand Center here in Winnipeg. And the percentage of those that are Indigenous, I don't get to see everyone, but my sampling is that, about, you know, in the 90 percentile. So it's astonishing and horrible.
And the Indigenous population of Manitoba is statistically,
I think, 15 or 20%. 15%.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a clear and obvious institutionalized racism. Yeah.
So when we talk about abolition, we're also just talking about justice for... Okay. So with that in mind, what are a few of the highlights from the... calls, Emily.
Call to action number 7. We call upon the federal government to develop with Aboriginal groups a joint strategy to eliminate educational and employment gaps between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Canadians.
Mm-hmm. So, education. So, so I'll just make clear first, there's the federal system and the provincial systems, right? And I've worked in both. I work in provincial right now. So my knowledge of federal is a little less immediate than my knowledge of provincial. Federal insiders are people who are serving more than 2 years. So, but the most people in Canada by far who are incarcerated are in remands. So, education in the provincial system here is almost non-existent. So I'm one of the few educational programs at remand. It might be the only one. We're not sure. At Headingley, which is the largest jail in Manitoba, there's theoretically teachers. They mostly pass out workbooks. I guess one of the huge misconceptions about jail, or things that people don't think about, is that there's no internet there. Mm-hmm. So since 2003 was when they last reviewed the internet rules. So this means there's nothing that has a hard drive, nothing that can be used to reach the outside world. And that includes post-secondary correspondence classes. So in the last 10 years or so, every university or college that offers correspondence has gone entirely online. So there's no post-secondary education for people in jails, and there used to be. So this was something that people could do. They could work and get their degree or get some classes towards a degree. So that's gone now. Latest budget cuts to Correction Services of Canada, they're cutting every librarian in the federal system. So this is a huge, huge hole in education in prisons. They say that they're going to, that the libraries will continue, but it's they just don't believe or understand. I'm being generous if I say they don't understand what librarians do. Mm-hmm. But there's a room full of books is not a library, and we know that. And libraries are like a central point where people can learn and grow, expand, do language classes.
We talked about earlier how, you know, important it is to, you know, connect with community. We talked about reconnecting with, like, you know, our faith communities and having accountability in that way.
Right.
A big aspect of literacy programming and supporting people who are incarcerated is helping Indigenous people connect with cultural programming and do that kind of that healing necessary for their communities. I'm wondering if you can speak a bit to how the literacy program can help facilitate this.
I hope it can somehow. I mean, we try and bring in as much. I bring in, for example, the women that I teach have been asking for powwow songs, and I bring in copies of powwow songs for them to read and sing. But I feel like education, it's just really, it's really difficult. So I guess I would say to that, I wish we could do something useful. But I feel like systemically we're really thwarted at every turn when we try to. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely cultural things in place in the federal system. There's they're supposed to be able to smudge, for example. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ways they get around making it so that you can't smudge. If someone complains that they're allergic or something, they shut down smudging. So that's usually, I've been to smudges out at Stony Mountain. It's on this little square in the parking lot, this tiny little square of grass. So yeah, stuff like that. The elders are paid less than chaplains. Mm-hmm. This is something that I find mm-hmm. quite interesting mm-hmm. and frightening. Mm-hmm. And the programming is, yeah, it's hard. It like the indigeneity, the total overwhelming indigeneity of, or indigenization of the jails here in Manitoba has not come with anything close to the cultural supports and educational supports it requires. So there's been lately some movement by this provincial government to put more money into adult education, so we're hoping that might lead to more education in jails. But yeah. Sorry, that's a bit of a bleak
no,
answer.
No, but this is, I mean, this is...
No, it's, if it's the yeah. honest answer,
it
because
is.
You've
yeah,
been doing
yeah,
this
yeah.
work for
right.
for a long time, and like, yeah, yeah again, you know, we're in the nonprofit sector as
right,
well,
right.
and so it's like we do the best that we can,
right.
and we are working with the resources that we have available to us
right.
to respond to.
So I guess I would say I don't think that systemically... we can change anything here or reform anything here at John Howard. The best we can do is empower the few people that we get access to be able to speak and allow us to recognize that they're human. So I feel like they're not treated that way in our society in general. So I feel like, yeah, I just lost the thread of my thought because I get agitated. I get really agitated when I think about all the stories I've encountered of people trying to get their lives back together and instead just sitting in cells for 22 hours a day. So it's really demoralizing often. For example, there's like everyone gets an opportunity to speak to sentence. Legally, right? So when you're sentenced, you can speak to the judge. Most people that I encounter don't feel confident enough to do that. Mm. And their lawyers often actively discourage them from doing so. Mm. I'm not sure why. Mm. But so one thing we try and do at remand is if we know someone is going for sentencing, we say, can we help you with something you want to say? Mm. And part of it is like, making sure they say what we know the judge wants to hear. Mm-hmm. And part of it is to empower them and recognize the context of where they are and who they are mm-hmm. and the fact that they are beloved mm-hmm. family and neighbors, mm-hmm. right? So so that, I feel like those moments are ones that I look for. Mm-hmm. And I think we, at this department, look for ways to kind of empower through communication.
And empowering people to find their voice
yeah.
is a key thing that educators do,
right.
Even if the context is prison
right.
and not
yeah,
just like
yeah.
elementary school or something,
that's
right?
True.
So,
yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, obviously it's gutting, it's super sad, but it is... Maybe the hope is in that it does offer something to empower people, and that is worthwhile.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Would it be helpful to name another of the TRC recommendations, or should you want to move on, or
well,
what do you think?
Yeah, I think that I do want to talk a bit about that. I think it's important to highlight just how difficult work in this sector
mm-hmm.
is
mm-hmm.
and how much more could be done
yeah.
and should be done.
What the challenges are, yeah.
And what the challenges are. And I think that's, you know, the theme of this weekend as well is like, mm-hmm. is like people trying to do the right thing, people trying to make a difference, dealing with kind of overwhelming systemic odds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's exacerbated, of course, for people who are incarcerated and who have this experience that they then need to try to rebuild their lives from, mm-hmm. with, you know, support that we can offer, but mm-hmm. again, the prisons are overcrowded.
Yeah.
And a lot, much more is needed. Given that there was a, you know, a new federal leader, the NDP is elected, we'll go on with the, we call upon the federal, provincial, and territorial governments to provide sufficient and stable funding to implement and evaluate community sanctions that will provide realistic alternatives to imprisonment for Aboriginal offenders and respond to the underlying causes of offending. We call upon federal, provincial, and territorial governments to commit to eliminating the overrepresentation of Aboriginal people in custody over the next decade and to issue detailed annual reports that monitor and evaluate progress in doing so.
Right.
We call upon the federal government to eliminate barriers to the creation of the additional Aboriginal healing lodges within the federal correctional system.
Mm-hmm.
And we call upon the federal government to provide more supports for Aboriginal programming in halfway houses and parole services.
Right.
So those are some of the other calls to action that are relevant to the work that we do. Mm-hmm. Last year, Prime Minister Mark Carney issued the statement, "As we mark 10 years since the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's final report, we pledge to build a future where survivors are honored with remembrance, with justice, with a stronger, fairer Canada, a Canada made stronger by the resilience of Indigenous communities. Reconciliation is a task that must be lived and practiced every day. We are seized with the task ahead of us." And that is, again, our statement from our Premier, Mark Carney. John, from your vantage point,
right.
Do you think Carney is living and practicing reconciliation every day?
I do not. I do not think that.
And what can we do to actually make some progress on these calls to action over the next 10 years?
Well, so, right. So his boilerplate that his staff wrote for him is kind of obviously nonsense.
Yeah.
And it's aspirational. And I guess you have to give credit for paying lip service to the TRC as like a cultural object, kind of.
Right.
It makes me think.
Your money where your mouth is.
Of course. But it makes me think that, like, you know, I heard from some people at the symposium yesterday, don't commemorate the 10-year anniversary of the TRC when, like, the majority of the recommendations haven't happened and, like, you know, people are rightly angry. At the same time, if as a cultural object that becomes a place that people can rally around and say, what the heck, like, how has this not been addressed? And it becomes almost like just like a rallying space. That could maybe achieve things, because having a federal government that understands their responsibility, I don't know, maybe the push wouldn't be that hard. So obviously he's not, like, you know, being genuine.
No.
But
you can take those words and try and use them to push forward, I guess. So it's just that the actions are totally the opposite, right? Like, so there's going to be teacher cuts next, I think, for the federal system. The provincial system here is a disaster. It's an absolute disaster. Like, there's no one who could look at it clearly and not say that. And there is absolutely no political will to do anything about it. In fact, the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
We've had politicians here in power, belittle and berate people who are in jail, buy into the idea of bail reform, which is a total racist disaster, mm-hmm. I think. So I guess I've been thinking about... So Friday night I went into... remand, and I had a class of women come down, and I did an opening exercise that I thought would be like just kind of like not that like emotional or anything, but I was like, if you could invite three people to dinner, who would they be and what would you cook for them? And so I was like, I don't know, like Karl Marx and Spider-Man and my grandma. Mm-hmm. So, like, every person around the table spoke about family who weren't there anymore. Every one of them. And talked about their families, and then talked about how many of them were talking about how they're locked up for 22 hours a day in an 8x10 cell. And one of the women was divulged to me that she's autistic, and it was not something that surprised me. She's very, like, overtly has all the touchstones of that. And she was saying, I just lie on the floor all day, and I get out for 2 hours a day. And part of that 2 hours they spent with me writing these exercises, right? That was really humbling. I was like, these are our families. These are our neighbors. I've had 2 weeks ago, a woman gave birth. She was in the hospital for 3 days. So one Friday she was there, and then the next Friday she was back at my class. So she'd been returned to jail. So all of these things really hit me. We also did a gratitude exercise that day. So it was, we went around asking, like, what are you grateful for today? And one of the women said, I'm grateful for the tiny window in my cell that I try and get up super early and look out of for a little while before the day starts and before my cellmates wake up. And she looks over the convention center. So she was, the Remand Center is right in downtown Winnipeg. It's right kitty corner almost to the convention center. And she said, I like it when there's conventions, especially the car shows, because they bring the cars in early and she gets to see all the cars and stuff. And I was struck by that, and I walked out, and it was Friday. It was the day that the convention started at the convention center, right? So I was like, this is a sign of something, right? Mm. This idea that there were people at the convention center at that moment being feted who were responsible for my students. So I was like, I'm still kind of working through what that means. But I guess trying to hold those people accountable and asking them to learn and change their policies. Not what they say, because they all say very good things, but their actual policies, which have led to the people that I work with's pain. So I feel like that was a moment for me. And then I was like, today, I don't know how far off we want to go here, and I feel like I'm not really representing John Howard particularly at this moment. I speak for myself.
Yes.
But the idea today in the news that that provincial NDPs are the people that that our federal party has to work with, I think the opposite is true. They have to earn our trust again. They have to do what's right. They have to, like, show us that they are thoughtful and loving and progressive people and politicians. So I feel like this all bubbled up for me today, trying to process what happened on Friday and then the politics of the country today. So I'm not sure what it means, but I feel like it's a story that contains a lot of my feelings about working with incarcerated people.
So I appreciate how deep that takes us as listeners to how you work and why you work and the people, as you say, the friends and the family and the neighbors that you work with. And it's really gutting, right? So for listeners, like, yes, I think we appreciate this. I want to end on, like, a little bit of a moment of hope. So just for me, I said I was bamboozled by the looking into the future with this NDP leadership convention, or feeling at least like the sense of possibility, and the feeling of being very anchored in the past with visiting the Ukrainian Labor Temple. But maybe I want to take a little hope from that, because even though we don't know what direction this takes left politics in Canada, it's much more hopeful than I could have imagined. And knowing someone will be in power who shares my values is very unusual. I just don't really know how to think about it. I believe Avi Lewis would be very receptive to everything that we just talked about, and much of it would probably not come as a surprise.
Yeah.
in the other direction, into the past, not only was the tour really lovely, but I was really shocked that the community center aspect of the Ukrainian Labor Temple is, like, resounding. There was, like, the church that was meeting there, the children were playing, they were dancing to K-pop and, like, doing line dancing to K-pop. It was so cool that that was, like, alive in this place that was built by a bunch of communists from the Ukraine.
Totally.
And that it exists today in Winnipeg as a space where community lives.
Absolutely.
So we can take some, I don't know, like, there are also good things. What I discovered just in
good people trying to do good work in very difficult circumstances.
And, and for me in Winnipeg, that, like, there was that, and then there's, like, anyways, the, there's all kinds of things, and I feel like I learned a lot.
I do love the idea of situating ourselves within a struggle that's so age-old and has a future, right? And this is, like, I feel like one of the things I love about Winnipeg is I can feel that here. I can feel it, that there's a real, like, that Ukrainian Labor Temple is, like, a site of organizing and tears and joy and all the things that a community does together, right? And it's a beautiful spot.
This weekend is a reminder that we are living in history.
Right.
We are all historical actors. We are all political actors. We have the ability to shape history in various ways, and we have a better chance at shaping history when we work together. And there are many pathways towards doing that, whether that is helping to shape someone's, you know, individual life by just helping them get their resume together,
right,
helping them get their birth certificate, helping them get like a pair of steel-toed boots for their new job, or helping organize in a political party or in a union or in any sort of community organization. Having people come together in Winnipeg from across Canada is a nice reminder, too, of how not alone we are in those struggles.
Right.
So that's what I appreciate, is just seeing people from across the country all trying to work in their different areas and make a difference.
I wait in four time. Yellow highway lines that you're relying on to lead you home. That you're relying on to lead you home. That you're relying on to lead you home.
Thank you, Andre, for coming in and having this conversation and doing what you do to make a community in the media space. So, thank you.
Emily Leadham, John Sampson Fellows from the John Howard Society. Thanks for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Is Bird Note. When waterfowl are in decline, hunters are some of the first people to sound the alarm and fund the recovery. Jared Hinson is a project manager with Ducks Unlimited, a nonprofit hunting and conservation group.
The North American model of conservation puts the bulk of the responsibility to fund conservation on hunters, because hunters in general are the consumptive users of those habitats, and they're just more willing to give money to that cause.
That money not only comes from hunting license sales, but also taxes on gear.
So guns, ammo, binoculars, all those sporting goods that you would use for hunting, a portion of that tax goes to the states, and they can then allocate that into conservation funding.
Financial support is just one way that hunters contribute to habitat management.
Waterfowl biologists and scientists have been leveraging hunters for data for almost 100 years now. But the big thing now is avian influenza. Hunters are some of the first to see the impacts of that in the field, especially since the main vector for it is waterfowl. And so hunters really play a big role in disease monitoring.
Learn more about how hunters support wildlife conservation in Season 8 of Bring Birds Back. Available in your favorite podcast app and on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Jazzy Johnson.